The Home Show with Sinead Ryan on News Talk.
Hello, you're very welcome along to the Home Show podcast with me, Sinead Ryan. Coming up this episode, well, it is a bank holiday weekend. Many of us will be embarking on DIY projects around the house. So we thought we'd ask some of our News Talk colleagues about their DIY skills, which are lacking in some cases, it has to be said. It's a new mini series, and we're starting this week with our own Lunchtime Live favourite, Andrea Gilligan. We all know that estate agents sell houses, but what about the novel idea of using one to buy a house? Well, we'll find out more from a UK expert who's doing just that. Maggie Malloy, presenter of RTE's Cheap Irish Homes, is now owner of a newly opened interior store. We'll be catching up with her. And Jennifer Sheehan is talking book drenching. If you'd like to get involved in the Home Show podcast, well, you can email us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You can find me on Instagram and on X. And of course, you can listen back to any shows, any episodes. They're all up on the Go Loud app. Now, it's another bank holiday, and this time it's coming into the summer season when we'll all be flinging open the doors and showing off our homes to neighbours and friends. So it's the ideal time of year to get stuck into a bit of DIY. Well, if the thought of that gives you the shivers, we thought we'd get some expert help in, or maybe not, from some famous faces in our mini DIY series. We'll be hearing from my News Talk colleagues about their do's and don'ts, their highs and lows when it comes to doing it themselves. First up this week, the erstwhile presenter of Lunchtime Live, Monday to Friday, Andrea Gilligan.
How are you?
Hello, how are you?
I'm not bad.
We're going to have a little bit of fun with this because I suspect we're not all natural DIYers.
God, no.
So let's start with a rating question. On a 1 to 10, with 10 being the best, how good are you at DIY?
But minus 1.
Oh,
I'd
dear
say. Yeah.
Me.
I can hang a picture, but even at that, I'm not really sure which hooks to use on what walls, but I'd chance it. I have done a little bit of painting in some of the smaller rooms, but I won't do it again. And that is the end of my DIY skills.
Is it because it gives you the stress or because you're just uncertain or...
Everything. I'm afraid of messing it up. I haven't a clue what I'm doing. I did do woodwork in first year in school and tech drawing. And I absolutely despised both of them.
Oh, right. Okay.
So this is just not my strong point in life. And I have decided at this point now in my life, Sinead, not to age myself. But I think there are lanes and the DIY lane is not mine. So I am not staying in it.
All right. Well, listen, yeah, we all have our talents.
Experts.
And isn't it the thing that if you recognise the talents we have and are happy to let go the ones we don't, that's fine. Start by telling us a little bit about your home because it's new.
It's new to me. It's not new. It's 1989. So I bought it 5 years ago in COVID, actually. So when I was kind of in the, you know, you got 15 minutes to view the house with the mask on kind of territory, but was fortunate enough probably to buy before things skyrocketed. So I was very lucky in that sense. The house itself, I think it was actually on a build to rent scheme from about 37 or 38 years ago. So the house was always rented. And when the people that owned it died and the kids came in, of course, and sold them all off in the estate. So it's now, I bought at a time when in my very small little estate, we're all in the last 5-6 years new to the estate. We're all owner occupiers now because prior to that, the houses had all been rented.
And does that mean, like, what was the quality of it like
poor
then? Was it? Yeah, because rented houses for that length of
exactly
time don't and get looked after.
No. And there had been nobody living in the house for about 18 months before I bought it as well. So everything from start to, like, the quality of the materials in the house are very poor. The structurally, the house is very sound, the engineers tell me.
Good.
But the stuff that was in it was very poor.
Okay.
Boilers not working, you know, just the quality of everything, the flooring, everything. So everything, I was very, you know, it was totally acceptable to live in it. And I did do that for 2 years because I couldn't afford to buy anything for it. But I kind of knew that with time, when I got a few pounds together, you know, each year I have tried to do something small. So
right. Now, when you say do something small, does that involve picking up the phone and getting somebody in to do it? Or do you are there any projects that you looked at and said, you know what, I could give that a go
be
cheaper?
Oh, geez, no way. No. Beyond paint and bedrooms. That's about the only project. That's it. Oh, no. So I've had to do the bathrooms done. I haven't hired architects or interior designers. So that's That's about the only part I've managed to do myself. I kind of thought I'd enjoy the project management element of it.
Oh, right.
Except I've realised that when you can't control the other people and, you know, their schedules and when they're going to have materials, I haven't even enjoyed that part either. So project management is not my strong point.
So the alpha owner, but the beta designer.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
What kind of things would you absolutely not go near? I mean, would you just say, it doesn't matter what happens? You were telling me earlier you had a leak.
Yeah, I came back after
house.
Christmas to, I was walking, thought my runners were wet on the floor and looked down, the water was just oozing out through
cracks
in the wooden floor. I really did get an awful fright. In fairness, the plumber was brilliant and he came over the next day and he was like, yeah, this is going to be a total mess. Now, the best bit of advice I got, he advised me to go and get my own independent claims assessor.
Yeah.
And that was game changing.
Yeah.
Because they look at things that I would never have even known to take into account.
They do, and people think it's a false economy, but actually they do, because even in a fire, they'll turn around and say, well, have you checked all the wardrobes upstairs? Maybe there's smoke on the clothes. Maybe they all need to be dry cleaned. You
skirting
need to put
boards,
in.
Everything. Yeah. I mean, things I never thought of. So the whole house from front door to back door had to be floors taken up, a trench dug down.
Yeah.
Pipes all taken out, replaced. It was a total mess.
Well, that would be, of course, beyond most homeowners, to be fair. But if it, so, you wouldn't be expected to do anything with that except get out.
Yeah.
But when it comes to something like you mentioned, like hanging a picture or painting a wall, is it the kind of thing, Andrea, that you'd like to be able to do it? Or is it like, I'm never going to enjoy this, so I don't want to learn?
Some people, like I see with some of my friends, they love the challenge of doing the work and figuring out this project, you know, and how to make the wardrobe or how to hang the shelves or how to do whatever. I don't enjoy that. Like, it's not for me that I get this immense satisfaction out of, you know, doing gardening and coming back and looking at this amazing, like, greenscape in a couple of weeks. I just don't enjoy that. So
but
it's not
for me.
Do
you enjoy the decorative piece? I mean, you want your house to look nice. So presumably you have shelves, you've cupboards, you've maybe vases of flowers or books. Or
I enjoy that.
So you
I love entertaining.
Okay.
So I love using the house. I love the social space of it. My favourite thing to do is have people over to the house. So, and it's not that I love to show it off, but I love to kind of, like, you know, maybe show the little things I've done, or I like to have two or three little features in the house. So I have a little, my under the stairs area, which is, the house is tiny, it's a glorified apartment basically. Like, so it, under the stairs, it was a little small area where the previous owners had, or tenants had, their washing machine. So I took that out and put it into the shed, and I've created a little under the stairs bar for myself. Yeah, not that I spent any time in it, but I love that when people are over, that there's this, like, kind of magic door feature. And when I had to end up doing up the house after, obviously, the leak, and I got my kitchen done and loads of different things like that in recent weeks, I painted it black, which I know sounds really random, right? And bear
with
me.
Do you know what?
Because
it's bang on trend.
Oh,
it's bang on trend. Dark colours for dark spaces.
Oh,
that's our rule on the home show.
Tiny, tiny, tiny little space. And I've painted it black. So it looks like a cellar. And I am absolutely, like, it is like my little pride and joy. It's, swear to God, I painted it.
And
I didn't paint
like
it.
Do you have, like, a bar with stools and a
No, not that. I've done, like, you couldn't, like, it's literally the width of me. Do you know what I mean? You're
what
not going to sit
like
there. Oh, I'll have to show you a picture of it. Yeah. So it's literally just the understairs of the house, and it has all the little optics, and obviously, being a publican's daughter, I've been able to steal a few bits from the pub at home, you know.
Fantastic.
So I
hope you don't charge your friends.
No, don't have a keg just yet, but that's in the making. But,
and pull a pint. All right. Well, listen, that sounds like a project that is close to your heart, and maybe your talents are in the effervescence of being a host rather than the nailing the things to the wall. So that is definitely a skill. Do you think this kind of thing should be taught in schools, Andrea?
I think the teachers have enough to teach, to be honest. Like, I think maybe in transition year is kind of, you know, a life skill course for a couple of months or something. Yeah, maybe fine. I mean, I don't think I'd be, you know, hard lobbying the schools. Student. Like, I think unlike maybe learning to swim or learning to cook, I think it is different to that.
Not a life skill.
No, I don't
think
it's
to have.
No, I think it's a nice, I think it's a transition year optional sort of a project. That's how I describe it.
All right. Okay. Well, you're still in it.
I'm still in it.
Year.
Yeah. Jesus.
And look, it sounds like a delightful place to live, and that your guests clearly have a bit of fun when they come over. And that's the most important thing about a home, isn't it, at the end of the
absolutely.
Day? All right. Well, listen, many more happy years
Thank
in
you.
It.
Thank you.
And well done for getting this far. It's no mean feat, really, to buy a house in these days. And it's always an achievement whenever you manage to do it. Andrea Gilligan, Lunchtime Live, Monday to Friday from 12 p.m. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks,
William,
for having me.
The Home Show on News Talk.
Now, we all know the role estate agents play when you're selling your house, but what about an estate agent who helps you buy one? Well, the Real Estate Agency Summit is coming to Dublin in June, and its keynote speaker is Richard Rawlings, one of the UK's best known property industry speakers and a buyer's agent, and he joins me now on the line. Welcome to the Home Show, Richard.
Good morning, Sinead.
This is a fairly new concept, at least in Ireland. So tell us more about where an estate agent acts on behalf of the buyer rather than the seller?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. It's certainly a topical one. I mean, historically, it's been the seller, of course, who's benefited from being represented by an estate agent. But the public don't seem to have noticed this. It's not a two-way street. The agent almost always represents the seller, of course, and their job is to get the most out of the buyer. So when an agent says on their website, you know, we'll find you the perfect home, it's actually a lie. What they really mean is we'll try and sell you a property that's on our books, irrespective of how perfect it is for you or may not be. You know, I mean, the agent, they'll get a deal over the line. That's everyone's objective. But at whose cost? A bit like a divorce lawyer, I suppose. They can't represent both sides without a conflict of interest.
You know? Indeed. So, and in the market here, and I presume the UK is the same, the commission or the percentage that the estate agent gets is usually based on the sale price. So they can be incentivized to get the best price available for their seller.
Absolutely. And there's an inbuilt conflict of interests here, which has actually just been completely proven in a law case in the States that's really eating away at estate agents' commission big time because they shared it there. And it was finally, as we would have always said, a conflict of interest. So the agent has tremendous power over which buyer their client accepts. You know, and they should be well trained in the art and science of property price negotiation. You know, the multiple bids on a property we're currently seeing in the market means that only the strongest buyer wins. Mm. And as you're right, you know, there is an incentive there for the buyer, the seller's agent. There always has been. Ultimately, though, the problem is the buyer bears more risk than the seller, and they stand to be on the losing end of the deal, yet it's only the seller who's usually professionally represented. You know, and that needs to change, and it is changing.
And the process of bidding itself can be a little bit of an art form. I mean, you know, when you're doing something that you only do maybe once, twice or three times in your whole life, there a sense that as a buyer you can get a little bit panicked and you're kind of chasing a tail of something that's ever moving, certainly in a constricted property market like Ireland, where, you know, properties are like hen's teeth at the moment. Mm-hmm. And what would you advise buyers to do in that scenario?
Well, the thing is, Sinead, I mean, it is an emotive purchase, and that makes it difficult for buyers to negotiate because they want the property and they feel, oh, well, if I negotiate too hard, I'll lose the property. The most important thing, but everyone must realize, buyer and seller, agent, buyer's agent, seller's agent, the ultimate objective is for the buyer to buy the property, not to get the best price on it. That's a secondary objective. It's an ideal scenario, but the primary objective is to get the property. And so, you know, these are what I'm talking about with representing agents representing buyers. It's not necessarily a specialist search agent. It's someone, as you say, in this market, regular agents offering their skills, advice and local knowledge to buyers as clients rather than as customers. It's a subtle difference, as poacher turned gamekeeper.
So how does it work, Richard? Because do you have kind of, is it like a broker then that somebody goes into an office? But because presumably a buyer's agent is also an estate agent who's selling. So how does that process then work in reality?
Well, that's a good question because, I mean, ordinarily, I mean, the buyer's light system that I'm going to be speaking about at the Real Estate Agency Summit in June, which I'm very much looking forward to, the buyer's agency system is one where it will be a regular estate agent. The buyer registers with the regular estate agent, probably attracted by one of the properties that they've been advertising. Hopefully, they'll buy one of that agent's properties, but the chances are they won't. There's probably a 90% chance that a buyer will not buy the property about which they first inquired. And, you know, despite having built a good relationship with the agent, the chances are that buyer will have to go and then form relationships with other agents who happen to have the property on their books. So, ideally, they'll buy one of that agent's properties. If not, the agent then offers them the buyer representation service. So they can't represent the buyer in respect of one of their existing properties. There would be a conflict of interest. They must represent their first client. And so, but after, as I say, after they've exhausted the supply of properties on that agent's books, and I know they're few and far between at the moment, then the agent would assess the applicant for buyer representation status. It doesn't suit everybody. And then they go out and not only perhaps find them a property, it's more, and it's also less than that. It's unlike a search agent. This is an agent where it may be, for example, someone's you've got a buyer who lives in Sligo and they want to move to Waterford. They don't want to be schlepping to Waterford every weekend to look at houses that may or may not be suitable. But if they could phone their trusted friend, Regina, who happens to be a Waterford estate agent, and say, "Hi, Regina, I've just seen a house advertised on My Home. Could you go and take a look at it for me?" Well, she'd say, "Fine, why not?" It's a bit like having a sister in the area who happens to be a cracking negotiator as well.
But the agent then is presumably going to their competitor estate agent who has the property listed. And like, how do they get paid? How does that work?
Okay. No, quite right. Again, good question. And bear in mind, remember that the seller's agent is paid by the seller. The buyer's agent is paid by the buyer. It is not coming from the seller's side. We are introducing an additional professional to the person who most needs representation into the equation. So in an ideal world, and this is what usually happens, the agent would go to their competitor and say, "Hi, I've seen this property on Coastal Drive advertised. I've got a buyer who I'm representing. Could I bring them around at 6 o'clock this evening, please?" Now, ideally and usually, that competitor will say, "Of course you can. I still get my commission. You get yours from the buyer. Two fellow professionals working together to get a deal over the line. What's not to like?"
And of course, the buyer's agent then is an estate agent, so they know the right questions to ask. Why Bijou translates into tiny and pokey, or why a project could mean the walls are crumbling. So they actually can kind of navigate through the speak of it. So you're paying them as a professional then to be independent in that role.
Can I just go back one stage?
Sure.
A second, if you don't mind. There may, of course, be some agents who don't get it. And when the buyer's agent approaches that agent, they say, "No way, you're one of my competitors. Of course, I'm not letting you look around my property." Then it would be perfectly reasonable for the buyer's agent to literally knock on the door of the seller and say, "I'm sorry, I'm not after any commission. I've got a buyer who wants to see your house. I mentioned it to your agent this morning, but they wouldn't cooperate."
Gosh.
And what does that do with the relationship with the existing agent who's been totally negligent? Because there's a hot buyer being represented and they've shut the door in their face.
Cat among the pigeons, Richard. That's what I'm expecting there, right? And listen, I want to ask you while I have you, the role of tech in the property industry, as everywhere, is just kind of accelerating at a pace that it's hard to keep up with. From online bidding, you know, these video tours around properties, AI visualization. I mean, it must be, for your business, it must be more positive than negative, is it? I mean, you've so many tools at your disposal now.
Yeah, and I think that can be very confusing for many estate agents, because there are many companies out there, be it CRM systems, AI, video tours, as you said, whatever it might be. They're all trying to sell them their service. And frankly, they were all pretty good, but an agent can't buy them all. So they have to be fairly selective as to what they take on. I mean, a good AI system now, I mean, it's one by a company called Your Estate Agency Automator, and they do incredible things. But the public has to be careful, because some agents will use AI to enhance their efficiency. In other words, with all their prospecting and everything, it doesn't necessarily make them a good agent, but the consumer will say, "Oh, I'm hearing from this agent all the time. They must be hot." And probably they are, because they'll be doing the same sort of prospecting with their buyers. But it can help an agent punch above their weight, just like the internet did initially. So sellers still have to be very selective as to who they appoint, and check out that they're dealing with real people of character, personality, integrity, professionalism, expertise, who have the persuasion skills as well to get a deal over the line to help people make decisions. So it's AI can really help real agency do its job really well.
Interesting. All right. Well, a cautionary tale there at the end. The Real Estate Agency Summit is on in Waterford on the 11th of June. It is open to the public. You can find tickets on the realestateagencysummit.ie. And Richard Wallings, who will be a keynote speaker at that, thank you very much for joining us on the Home Show today. Now, finding a house to buy in Ireland is challenging enough without your budget being less than 100,000 euro. But it's a challenge my next guest rose to and turned it into a television series called, appropriately, Cheap Irish Homes. These days, Maggie Molloy has turned her talents into an interiors store, which opens this weekend. But in keeping with her tight budgetary theme, it will only sell second-hand items. Maggie Molloy, welcome back to the Home Show. Tell us first about the reason that you pivoted into interiors.
I feel like interiors is a really nice description of what I'm doing. Honestly, I was working in old houses a lot, and I was dealing with people who were either inheriting houses and they didn't know what to do with the items that they were left, or young people buying houses that didn't really need the items that were just left behind in the house. And a lot of people just honestly didn't really know what to do with the things. So I would just say, look, if you're going to throw them in a skip, could I at least take the stuff that I think I can rehome, and then you can deal with the rest of the stuff yourself? And it kind of started from there.
So have you been skip diving to look for, to find stock, or are you kind of just taking them off of people you know?
No, it's very much just people get in touch with me when they have items in houses and they don't really know what to do with them. And it's very much on a house by house basis. It only happened very infrequently in the beginning. Like, there was one night at 11 o'clock, I got a call from a friend, and he said that he was in a house with somebody and they had an axe and an old Irish dresser and they were about to break it up and put it on a bonfire. And he said, if I can get there at 11 o'clock at night, the dresser was mine, and I just got into the Jeep at 11 o'clock at night.
Well, he couldn't contain himself to the morning.
Well, he'd been working at the stuff all day, and he was clearing out a house to rent it. And this guy was only in his early 30s, and he just honestly didn't think anyone would want any of the stuff. And it was going to cost him hundreds of euros to get skips in. Mm. So he just, like, people genuinely don't know what to do. If you're living in rural Ireland as well, it's not second nature for you to just leave stuff into a secondhand shop, because a lot of them, they're not local to us. You know, they're quite far away. They could be maybe a half an hour, an hour's drive away in a town. So it's not second nature for people in the countryside to do that. And they get just kind of a bit lost, I think, and overwhelmed.
Right. And I suppose the Irish dresser that you mentioned, that has become one of those pieces that I think probably every single home had in the 1960s and the 1970s, and hardly anybody has it now. I mean, people just aren't incorporating kind of those presses down below with hanging cups and delf and all of that up beyond. Do you find that there are people, a lot of people out there who are just like, I don't want to break it up because it was my grandmother's, but I've no use for it?
That's the same with everything. There is a huge sentimentality for this stuff. And especially when people remember how much their grandparents thought of the stuff. Do you know, like, this is stuff that's been in a house, could be 100 years, passed down through generations. I've had dressers in that were from the 1800s. Like, this is dressers that have lasted through so many periods of our history. And people just, they can't fit them into their new builds. They don't necessarily think they're going to suit, and they just don't know what to do.
So tell us a little bit about the store. It opened today, I believe. What's it called? Where is it?
So there's no name as such on it. It's just my surname over the door. So I suppose Molloy's is the name of it.
Good start.
And it's in my hometown of Carnew in County Wicklow.
Right, so no pressure. All the neighbours will be dropping in and maybe find items that belong to people they know.
Well, no, a lot of the house clearances I do, honestly, are, you know, Leitrim, Mayo, Cork, a lot of Tipperary stuff. It's funny, I think a lot of the houses in Wexford, they tend to be, they've just been lived in so consistently that they've kind of moved along with the times a lot quicker. Do you know, we don't really have empty houses up in Wexford and Wicklow as much. So houses just don't stay locked in time for as long. It's definitely a lot more, I travel a lot more for the stuff than just get it from home
next door. All right. And of course, what can people find here? Because this isn't a case of going into a store and saying, look, I love that sofa, but do you have it in blue? It's going to be the stock that you have. Is it large pieces of furniture, or is it small bits and pieces?
It's everything size-wise, but at the same time, it's quite highly curated. Like, I do like a certain thing. Mm. I like stuff that's pretty and colourful, functional, very nostalgic, but I'm not, like, I won't put everything in the shop. It's not just full of old brown mahogany furniture. It's very colourful. Like, I love a good pastel bathroom suite. I have three pastel sinks on the wall in the shop and I have a queue of people waiting to take
them
off.
They are on the way back. I'm telling you, people love that retro thing now and they're buying their avocado bathrooms again. Now, in terms of housing, Maggie, I mean, you've always been fascinated with what estate agents like euphemistically term projects, you know, which to some of us, it looks like a pile of bricks with the roof on it. What is it about doing up a bit of a ruin, a bit of a derelict house that you find appealing? What do you see that other people don't?
Gosh, I don't know. I do think there's probably just something in me, first of all, that loves old things. I love the kind of just the feeling that someone has lived there before, that there's a story and a history to something. Like, that's very much a personal thing for me. I'm also quite frugal. And I know that if you get something that needs work on it and you can do the work yourself, you can save money. That was always a big thing for me when I was younger. It still is, even with the shop. Mm. I just, you know, the idea of not being wasteful and using what's already there, it just makes sense. I don't know, in my bones, it makes sense. Mm. You know? Mm.
Now, of course, there's no denying that turning a pile of bricks into a warm, comfortable A-rated home, like, it's an enormous amount of work. You wouldn't undertake it. It's not for the faint-hearted, isn't that right?
It's not, no. But at the same time, I think when you're doing that level of a renovation, you're not the person doing the work either. Do you know? You're getting people in to do it. So you're not, like, if you're getting like deep retrofitting done, there's somebody else doing it for you. You're not doing that yourself, you know? But it is a big project. You're right. It is. It's not for everybody.
What are the key things you'd recommend for somebody who only has a very, very tight budget, like the one you had on the TV series? What did you find over the course of the series that people had to know or had to get right to make this work?
Honestly, it comes down to one thing, and it's so funny because I don't think I've ever actually said this before, but it comes down to finishes in houses. If you take on even a deep retrofit or you take on just a very kind of light-handed renovation, you will blow the budget entirely the second you start wanting a 30,000 euro kitchen, or you start wanting really expensive flooring. You want the best of the best of the furniture. Now, I'm not talking buying secondhand. I'm just talking being a bit more sensible about what you're buying. You will double your budget on interiors easily on the interiors. And I think people want to keep up with the Joneses still. They very much do that. When you look at the renovations on the show, the ones that come in really, really affordably are ones where people said, do you know what? That kitchen is actually okay. Or, you know, I sanded down all the floors, but I didn't replace them. It's things like that. It's just being smart about what you leave in and what you fully replace at the end when it comes to the look of the place.
Yeah, because I suppose to some extent the easy solution is tear everything out and put in brand new. But it's really expensive to do that. And I suppose there's no point in spending 100,000 on a house, on a property, and then having to double it because you want everything perfect and pristine. Yeah.
And, you know, it's the people that do that, that come back to me and go, sure, it's not really any more affordable to buy an old house. Mm. And I do be thinking, well, it is if you do it right. It is. If you don't need an 80,000 euro house and you come up at the end of it and you have a 360,000 euro mortgage. Mm. Like, you're not, that's not doing it right.
Yeah. Yeah. You might as well buy turnkey if you're going to do that. Do you think, Maggie, that there's a sense that we're less likely now, or we're more reluctant to kind of make do and mend, go into our house and maybe wait a few years to get a sofa, you know, a new sofa, to kind of build it up slowly? It used to be the case that, you know, before, when people got married and they hadn't lived together and they hadn't had, you know, property together, that they would wait, you know, a year or two to just get their things the way they want them to. And is there a sense now that everybody just wants everything perfect and Instagrammable?
I think it is drilled into us, though, isn't it? I honestly think you see it everywhere. Like, you see it on Instagram, like you're saying, you see it in interiors magazines, you see it in newspapers, everywhere. This kind of fake vision of what everyone's living like is pushed on you. And really, when you go out into Ireland the way I do, and you're in regular people's houses, like, we're all in regular people's houses every day, and the houses don't look like that. Yeah. But young people think they do. Like, you almost have to give young people permission to do what our parents did. You have to kind of say, look, this is okay, and we're not going to shame you for doing this.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to look down on you if you don't have everything perfect.
Yeah.
I think they feel like they have to keep up with the Joneses, do you know? And it's tough. It's a lot of pressure.
It is indeed. Now, there's another series of Cheap Irish Homes on the way.
There is, yeah. We are filming it at the moment. I'm on the third episode now of filming it. I think we're on season 7 at the moment.
Wow. Okay, so there are Cheap Irish Homes out there. You can buy them. And if you watch the series, which is coming up on RTE, you can find out how to do that with Maggie Molloy. Maggie, thank you so much. The very best of luck with the store, Molloy's, down in Carnew in Wicklow. And I hope it goes well for you. Inauguration day today, but it will, I'm sure, be a great addition to that part of the world. And you can find Maggie at Cheap Irish Houses and at maggie.molloy on Instagram. Maggie, thanks a million.
No problem. Thank you.
The Home Show on News Talk.
Now, we are all book lovers on the Home Show, so there's always the dilemma of how to display and store volumes that we collect. Do you have a TBR pile like me, or three? On windowsills and bedside lockers, have you shelves with stacked books looking an absolute mess? Well, there is a more creative solution that fulfills all of these needs. And here to tell us about it is Home of the Year winner, Jennifer Sheehan.
Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Great.
Now, this is called, this movement, if we're going to call it that, is book drenching.
Yeah.
Now, we've covered colour drenching on the show.
Yeah.
That's where you paint your ceilings and your walls and your skirting boards and everything the same colour. Talk to me about book drenching.
I mean, it's the same concept. It is wall to wall, floor to ceiling, wrap it around the doorway, wrap it around your windows. You know, every available inch of the wall is covered in books and bookshelves.
A library.
It's a library.
Okay.
Somebody clever has coined a new term for a library. But yeah, it is.
Okay, but you don't need a separate room for this. This isn't, we're not talking grand houses here where you go in and smoke your cigar and have a kind of a wing chair. This is just incorporating this trend
wherever
as a storage solution.
And
really.
I think when you think about colour drenching, and I've said this loads of times before, it's not so much a trend as a course correction towards a much better way of painting our house. I mean, we should never go back. And actually, this makes sense in a similar way because it's kind of simpler to just cover an entire wall or a space with, you know, floor to floor, wall to ceiling. Now, I know we're talking about probably custom and built-in joinery here as opposed to flatback.
Yeah.
So it's a bit more expensive unless you're handy. But it is easier. It's harder to think, you know, where do you wedge in a bookshelf? Because it kind of pokes out and it might not make sense in a certain space, and what do you do with the rest of the wall, and it could be asymmetrical. So if you think about it from a design perspective, it's actually easier to just take the entire surface in front of you, even if there's windows around it or there's doorways in it or whatever, and just cover the entire available space in books and bookshelves. It's simpler, it looks more symmetrical, you've more space. And I think, you know, obviously the downside with this trend is you need to have a lot of books, right?
That's a downside.
Which is, well, it's not for me. I love books. I have stacks of books everywhere.
But you're right. You can't have, this isn't something you can do with gaps. And, you know, like when we've covered bookshelves and bookcases on the show before, it's always like put them in little piles of three and then put a vase and then put a little ceramic thing and then have another three books. That's not what we're talking about
here. And the first
thing
that comes to my mind when I think about that trend, which does look beautiful, is dust. Because that is just wide open, please cover me in dust situation, isn't it? And I can't be dealing with that.
Okay, so let's talk about then the practicalities of this. Because, you know, just in terms of the structure of the shelving, we're not talking about a Billy bookcase here. We are talking about the ceiling to the floor. Is that important? Because you don't want, this is the feature.
This is the feature. Now, I'll take you back on this because you could do Billy bookcases floor to ceiling. And I saw this last week. I was over in Salone in Milan, and IKEA had a full book drenching installation at there. So they had two full long walls in a cafe covered in their Billy bookcases. And, you know, I'm an IKEA fan. So it does work. But you can't, you know, you can't have a flimsy bookshelf.
Okay.
You need something that is built for books.
Because they're heavy.
Something sturdy. They're heavy. It needs to be secured to the wall.
Yeah.
And that's important. So you need to be able to screw it into the studs. If you have a newer home, potentially you have metal studs. So if you know you're going to put a bookcase against a certain wall, you need to tell your builder that now if you're renovating so they can put in some support. And it can't be flimsy because books are really heavy. Mm. And I, you know, not to, to state the obvious, but if you're putting up a flimsy old shelf and you cover it in books, number one, it might fall down. Or if it doesn't, it's going to just warp over the years and sag, and it looks awful. So start with sturdy enough shelves that can carry books.
Okay.
That sounds obvious, and make sure it's secure to the wall.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the depth of it, I mean, books come in all shapes and sizes. Do you want it further out than the longest book?
Not much, I would say, because if they, if they're too deep, again, you're talking about dust. I know I sound obsessed, but like if you're doing, if you're covering a wall in shelves, you want to minimize your amount of dust. Mm. And if it's too deep, it looks a bit echoey, empty. I don't love that look personally. So, and most books aren't that big. Maybe you put the big book somewhere else. You know,
like
you
the just coffee table your, books.
Yeah.
You could put those on their side, maybe. And okay.
Because I do prefer it. I don't mind it messy, but if things are at least similar-ish sizes, so I would just go standard. I wouldn't go too big. And you don't, you know, if you know you're only going to be putting kind of soft copy books on it that aren't too big, you can get shallow enough bookshelves. Like it doesn't have to be full depth shelf, which is great news for maybe a hallway. You know, if you've got a long hallway that you're doing nothing with and you want to cover one side of it in books, I love that look.
Now, of course, for people like me and you and our home show listeners, these are real red books. So the books you've collected, books you want to read, books you have read, books you can't get rid of. And I mean, I'll throw out clothes quicker than I'll throw out a book.
Me too.
You know, it's
but
just
I give
something.
Them away. Giving and getting, it's my favourite thing. And I have a tradition with a friend, and she always writes a little sticky note in the book as to why she thinks I might like it. And that's, I don't care if it's been regifted, that is the best birthday present you can get, I think.
Well, I was talking to one designer who shall remain nameless, who would be on the posher end of things. Mm. And certainly not designing not anything end. In my house, but certainly on the super posh end of things, and was designing the interior, kind of one of the drawing rooms or living rooms for a client who wouldn't be known for their, you know, maybe educational attainment, and was sent out to auctions to buy hardback leather bound.
And you say
books.
Auctions, not the charity shop. Meaning
no,
these are
no. So the display. The, yes, exactly. So that the impression was this is a serious library with first editions and leather bound and all that kind of thing. I'm thinking this is a decorative piece, but it's also for books you're going to return to and you want to read again and again.
And that
it's
makes
a,
me
it's
a
cosy
sad.
Theme, isn't it?
It's cosy and it's personality. Like this trend is not for you if you're not into books. You know, don't display something that isn't yours in your home, because then it won't feel like your home and it's not interesting. And, you know, I think that situation, if someone's coming over, I love browsing someone's bookshelf. Have you read this? What do you think of that? You know, oh, that looks interesting. Could I borrow that? I'll spot this. You know, you've been to whatever, you've got a travel guide, you know, tell me about that. Like that is a huge reflection of someone's personality. And I really love that. But not everyone is into books, and that's fine. Display what you are into if you want to.
Now, getting to the books is another thing, because, I mean, these are red books and they're ones that you want to go back to and maybe reference books or whatever, depending on what you're using them for. So to access, like, the ones high up. What is, like, are we into little stepladders?
I mean, if you've got the type of house that can support a full-time library ladder, then go for it. Because
these
I
are
love
the ones
that.
On a rail
on
where
a
you
rail.
School. Very Agatha Christie or Hogwarts, isn't it? Okay.
I mean, that's my dream. I mean, I'd have a house built of books if I could, and I've had ladders everywhere, and it'd be heaven. I'd be in there all day. I'd never leave. But if you can support that type of look, great. And you don't need a huge amount of space to do that. So if you're the type of person who thinks you might like a ladder, go for a ladder. Otherwise, a little step ladder that you can pull out and, you know, put away somewhere neatly is fine.
Now, we have to get on to a very thorny and controversial topic now, Jenny, because we've talked about the structure and making sure there's enough weight in it and all your books and all that. Now, when it comes to display.
Yeah.
Are you somebody who curates by author, by genre, or by colour?
No, I'm certainly not somebody who curates by colour. That wouldn't be me. That wouldn't be my style. That sounds...
Your face looks as if it shouldn't be anybody's style.
I think if you're that organised, I'm thinking back to one of my good friends who organised her wardrobe by colour and how jealous I was of her organisation skills. So I'm just jealous is what I'm saying. But it's not for me.
Well, the wardrobe makes complete sense because things have to go with other things.
And she did have fabulous style, so it worked in that instance.
I would never be able to keep that. But books,
I will say my own bookshelves are loosely organised by category because I have a lot of cookbooks and I like to read cookbooks
okay.
as opposed to go into them for recipes.
So you want them all together?
So I like those together. I have a good few kind of interiors, DIY, you know, those type of hobby type books, and I love those. They're loosely grouped together. I will say I have some books that I potentially picked up meaning to read, never got around to. They're in a certain space that I know I'm probably never going to get to.
That's but your
I'd to like
be read, your TBR.
It's going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And then I've kind of just the novel. My taste in books isn't brilliant. I'm here talking away about books all day long as if I'm some literary, you know, critic.
That's not really the point. It's really about that comfort piece.
Yeah.
What are the things when you turn around and it brings you back to, I don't know, a place in Sicily or, yeah. you know, somewhere in Provence or inner city Dublin, or a book gives you that memory and that evocation of another world, a story. Isn't that the more important thing than how it looks?
I do have a number of them that I will pick up time and again that I've read through, you know, quite a few times. Or if I'm in between books or I'm waiting, because I use the library a lot, so if I'm waiting for my next book, you know, to be ready, I'll dip into those. So I do love that. I like having them nearby, kind of accessible.
So we're going to curate it then. That's a sensible thing to do, is curate it by, you know, structure, really. These are my library books.
Roughly.
These are my, you know, non-fiction. These are my fiction. Okay, that's right. There is a book trend, which I'm nervous to mention on air because I think we're both find it horrific, of curating books for design aesthetic purposes with the pages out.
A hard pass. Absolutely not. No. What am I going to do? Go over to someone's house and browse?
You see, I'm thinking these aren't books for browsing. This is like how to create a beige wall without it being...
No, books are not your answer. No, paint it. No, right.
Look it up,
sorry,
folks.
If you're at home and you've done that. But
Google
how do you
it
see?
On the internet. It is books facing pages out. I'm sure there's a name for it. I've no idea what it is. I never want to see it in my house.
Listener, don't Google it. Just forget that ever happened. Don't think about it again. Put it from your mind. No.
Okay, well, on that note, we will draw a close to our book this week on the Home Show. And Jenny Sheehan can be found at Workers' Cottage on Instagram, where she might. No, you might be doing this, will you?
I'm happy to put up
over
pictures of all my books.
Yeah,
and
it's a good
I'd love to get into
solution.
A book discussion. I want book recommendations, actually, is my favourite thing to get as
all
a
right.
message after
you
this.
You can DM. Yeah. At Workers' Cottage with all of that. And that's it. That's all we have time for on this episode of the Home Show podcast. I do hope you enjoyed it. And of course, if you missed any of it or any other pods, they're all up there on the Go Loud app and you can find the Home Show there. If you'd like to get in touch with us during the week, it's thehomeshow@newstalk.com. We do love to hear from podcast listeners to let us know what you'd like us to feature on an upcoming episode, who you'd like us to have on. We'll do our level best to accommodate that. My thanks to producer Aoife Breen. Stephen McLoone was on sound, and we will be back next time with a new episode. Why don't you like and follow? It's completely free and you won't miss anything that's coming up. Have a wonderful bank holiday weekend. See you next time.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan. Saturday at 5 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.